Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello. You're listening to BFN. This is the podcast about infertility, IVF, and the trials of trying for a baby. I'm Gabby.
And I'm Emma. And we are both card-carrying members of the Infertility Club.
Hello. Hi, guys.
How are you?
I hope you're all well.
Guess what?
What?
We're on holes.
We're on holes, we are.
We are.
We're by the seaside.
We are by the seaside, very much.
Well, actually, I'm on my holes. You're just in your house.
Yeah, but it's kind of like being on holes, isn't it?
It's a bit like being on holes, yeah.
So it's a little bit echoey because we're in a room without carpets this time.
Yes. In Emma's bedroom.
Yeah, you might hear some cars go past during the episode.
Yes.
If you're lucky, you might hear a seagull.
Indeed.
You won't hear the sea because we're not that close to it.
Yeah, I woke up hearing seagulls this morning, which is one of my favourite things.
And we woke up and there was a dead seagull on the street, wasn't
also
there?
Also dead seagull, yes.
Yeah.
He wasn't making too much noise.
So, yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Basically, Emma invited me and Mr. Gabby to come and have a weekend in Margate.
Yeah, and we have... What a weekend we've had.
Oh, it's been lovely.
Yeah. We had the sunshine yesterday.
Yeah.
Today we've got the traditional British seaside, overcast.
Yes.
Rain threatened.
And of course I've only brought shorts, yeah. So I'm going to have cold legs today.
Yeah, but they're great legs, so you're okay.
Oh, shut up.
So today is part two of our conversation with Julia Bueno.
Yes.
Talking about miscarriage,
yeah.
Baby loss, pregnancy loss, however you want to refer to it.
Yeah, we got a lot of positive feedback after last week's episode. I think it was a conversation that a lot of people appreciated hearing.
Yeah.
And I think it's a great one. It's a good to split it into, I think.
And also I think one thing that quite a lot of people said was that they liked the fact that she acknowledged the fact that if you have a failed IVF round,
yes.
Or even just trying yeah. for a baby,
the grief is valid too.
Yeah, that grief is valid.
That it
yeah.
lives in the family of, you know, baby loss. It's in there.
It is. So yeah. So you know, you can acknowledge your losses.
Mm.
Anyway, also while we're talking about difficult stuff, a couple of episodes, maybe three episodes ago, I mentioned the fact that I had had like some kind of mental health issues during my infertility and that I'd had some like quite dark thoughts. And I got a lot of messages from people after that. One thing that I wanted to mention is that if you're having the same thing, if you're like really struggling, there is a group called the British Infertility Counselling Association who provide for a small to large degree infertility counselling. They are specialists.
Mm.
You can find their website at bica.net.
Great.
Also, you go to your GP, talk to them, tell them how you're feeling. Most clinics should have an infertility counsellor.
Yeah.
It's good to have someone who's trained, and like I certainly had a counsellor who was trained in infertility counselling who could really help me to understand what was going on with my body, but also what was going on in my head. So, just, you know, worth
absolutely
considering.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out.
That's all right, mate.
In slightly yeah. more happy news.
Yes.
You may have heard us talking a number of times about a lady called Arielle, who has been in the process of launching something called Co-Fertility
mm-hmm.
for a while. we met her last year and we were talking about her plans, and then I met up with her in New York.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. And it's launched. Co-fertility is live.
Awesome.
And basically, yeah, it's probably most useful for our American listeners, because it has a lot of kind of related content in terms of like the grants that are available and the way to navigate insurance, etc. But it also, basically the site is trying to answer fertility questions that everyone has.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of relevant content there for anyone who's going through this. Yeah. Questions around male infertility, AMH. and yeah, I think it's really nicely designed.
It's
very user-friendly.
Very good.
And there's also a community element in it. So you can kind of ask questions. You can like meet like-minded people. So yeah, it's just, it's a really great thing. And we are sure it's going to do very well.
We are. And also she's not even paying us to say this.
She's not. She's not. She's just a lovely woman who, yeah, is doing something great for the community and who is going through this herself. So yeah. Understands implicitly the experience that we're having. So.
Absolutely. So you get on there.
Yeah.
What else? Did we need to say anything else? I don't think we did. Oh, Professor Tim.
Oh, of course.
He's talking about a very seasonally appropriate thing.
I believe so.
Yeah, you do.
Antihistamines. We've had a few people write in to say that they have hay fever problems and they're not sure whether they can take antihistamines.
Yeah.
I have a similar experience. We'll talk about that later. So yeah, we put it to Prof Tim.
Yeah. So he's talking about whether you can take it when you're doing IVF.
Yeah.
Or just in TTC.
Yeah.
And that's really it, other than to say you can rate and review and subscribe and like and whatever else you want to do the podcast anywhere you get your podcasts.
You can indeed.
You can... Oh, can you hear some seagulls?
Oh.
I think I heard some.
I did too.
Yeah. Oh, how atmospheric. You can follow us on Instagram.
At Big Fat Negative.
Or you can follow us on Facebook.
Big Fat Negative.
Or you can follow us on Twitter.
At Big Fat Negative.
Or you can email us.
BigFatNegativePodcast@gmail.com.
Please enjoy the episode.
Speak to you soon.
So we're joined again by Julia Bueno.
Hello.
Who...
Thank you for having me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Coming.
I mean, to be fair, there's been a 5-minute break. We should be honest here. Full transparency.
Oh, I like the idea of...
We didn't make you trek to Notting Hill again. You're the author of The Brink of Being, which is about talking about miscarriage.
I'm going to challenge you there. It is a book about talking about miscarriage, but had I had my way,
okay,
it might have had a different. I want people to think about miscarriage. I think that is the first step. Just thinking about this before you talk, before you respond, because I'm not in the business of telling anybody to say something or prescribe what to say or what to do. I think people need to hear an authentic kind of response from somebody. So I just want that somebody to think through what they feel about miscarriage, why they might have shied away from it, why they might find it difficult or awkward to talk about, and then, you know, then come to their own response.
That makes sense to me. So we talked last week /5 minutes ago about the different types of miscarriage or baby loss
that you
can experience. And I guess the language there, again, is like quite, you know, is discussed a lot in the infertility community. What's your preferred term?
Gosh, there's a question.
Because miscarriage, as you said last week, is
quite
blamey.
Yeah, don't like miscarriage. It's quite blamey. Mm. Pregnancy loss? I'm pausing there because, of course, I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm going to come up with a good enough answer for you. Pregnancy loss doesn't suit everybody because that implies kind of loss. Like I've mislaid something and means more than that. I think we just have to muddle around with words while tuning into what we're hearing from the other. I didn't I personally, pregnancy loss did better for me than miscarriage.
Fair enough. One of the bits of your book that I enjoyed, well, not enjoyed, but I found quite comforting, was that stories of miscarriage frequently kind of remind you of the courage of women. You know, the things that people are able to continue
withstand.
Doing. And I think it's been in the news a couple of weeks ago with Stella Creasy, MP, talking about the things that she did during her miscarriages. Can you give us a little kind of example of the things that you've heard?
Gosh, well, I don't know where to kind of start or finish with that one, because I think so many women, miscarriage doesn't discriminate, does it? I mean, it can hit us driving a car, swimming in Tesco's in the middle of a presentation. I write about in the book, you know, I went for a wee 16 weeks pregnant before seeing a client in a consulting room, and I was bleeding, and I knew my body well enough to know that this was the beginning of a miscarriage and I could feel some cramping. I had no choice. I had to go walk into the consulting room and sit there for 50 minutes and think I had a client after that as well. But so that's, you know, that's just one example. But so, you know, there's no kind of perfect timing for it, and women just crack on. But there's also something about the shock. I think that we you know, you don't necessarily compute that the miscarriage is happening, or you might want to deny it's happening, or you do know it's happening, but you're just so shocked you can't think straight. And that's what happens when we're in shock. You know, our threat system comes online in the brain and it scrambles our thinking. So there's that to it, but also there's, I think, a reality that what do you do? Do you just put your hands up and go, sorry guys, I'm having a miscarriage? Because there isn't that language there isn't that space there. You might say, whoa, I'm just thinking on my feet here, but I'm really sorry, but I've got food poisoning, I think I'm going to vomit everywhere. And people would make space and they'd go, yeah, sure. But, you know, if you were to say, look, I'm really sorry, I've got some cramping and I'm pregnant, I think I'm going a miscarriage, you know, people would be aghast, wouldn't they? They'd be floored.
Do you know what? I remember a few years ago, I mean, this must have been about 10 years ago, right when Twitter first started, there was a woman who tweeted, I'm in a board meeting or something like that, I'm in a meeting and I think I've just had a miscarriage, I'm so relieved.
Right.
Obviously, it was an unwanted pregnancy, but the reaction to that was, oh, you're disgusting, how can you be so blasé, how can you... And she really got absolutely, like, it was one of the first kind of Twitter storms.
It's ringing a bell. Yeah.
I don't know why I remember it so well, because it was way before I ever even thought I would want to be a mother. But I just remember thinking it was really unfair that this woman who had had something happen to her, that, you know, whether she wanted that pregnancy or not, it's not very nice having a miscarriage.
No.
That she was just being attacked in this way for being honest. But I guess that's what happens when you are that open about it.
Yes. And again, I think that just kind of shines a light on the individuality of pregnancy and pregnancy loss. And that's something that I really hope to kind of convey in my book, that, yes, my book is very much about the grief of miscarriage and the disenfranchised nature of that and the misunderstanding of that. And we've been talking a lot about the kind of heavy weight of grief that can flow in the wake of really early loss or unconceived loss. But I do hope to make space for the fact that you can, as you say, experience a miscarriage and maybe not, you know, not experience a grief, but it be just a horrible, horrible visceral experience to go through. And you know, as I said, a miscarriage can involve tremendous blood loss and incredible pain. And you know, that is deserved of sympathy and compassion too. Yeah, I'm with you.
It's a stupid thing, actually. No one, I never really thought about the fact that miscarriage would involve pain.
Right.
I just always thought, you know, it's, you lose a lot of blood, it's like a period.
Well, I think that's a time-honoured myth. I think that is a story that gets passed down. And I have heard of a lot of women who have been told that by medics and otherwise, but some miscarriages can be, and I've spoken to plenty of women who would describe it as, actually, it wasn't too bad, it was like a really heavy period. But even early miscarriages against that can be excruciating. Mm. And, you know, that those are the stories I think I hear more of. But then, yeah. You know, I would do because I...
I mean, one, we've talked a lot about the experience of a woman having a miscarriage, but one of the things you also talk about in your book, of course, is the experience of a partner.
Yeah.
Who is also experiencing a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And the kind of different ways that, specifically talking about men in this context, but also obviously that can be the same for lesbian couples.
Yeah.
That they have to kind of show a kind of strong front and kind of swallow their emotions.
Yeah, and I think when I talk about that in the context of men, I contextualise that in the kind of culture that we're in. You know, I think it is changing, and good old Prince Harry et al. But I think it is fair to say that men do still feel a cultural pressure to be strong, and also a kind of they lack reproductive narratives that we have, you know, that they're not allowed, that they're expected to be virile, you know, as soon as they reach puberty until they die, you know, that they can father kids, and they're expected to be, you know, up for it and have to be able to have sex whenever they want. You know, it's very difficult for a man to be broody. It's very difficult for a man to have low sex drive. It's very difficult for, you know, lots of kind of reproductive vulnerabilities for men to claim. So I contextualise that, you know, for the case of the male partner, hello, cat.
so, you know, inappropriate.
Not being allowed to be vulnerable in their reproductive lives, but not being allowed to be vulnerable full stop. But there is a reality that the miscarriage is happening in a woman's a partner's body, and that, as we've just said, can be really painful and really, really scary to watch. So a lot of partners do have to step up and be strong and supportive, because they might have to bundle me in a car and drive me to hospital, or because of NHS staffing, might have to change your bedpan or your pad or your drip, in my case, literally.
Your partner changed your drip?
He did have to change a bag of drip once, with some instruction. So that, you know, all of that stacks up to making it very difficult for a man to be vulnerable, on top of, you know, him sort of perhaps feeling that he's got to hold it together. But the same applies to a female partner too. If it's not happening in her body, she's going to have to sort of step up and support her partner. And I think with a female partner, my experience of working with lesbian couples is that because we expect women to be good at all of that, you know, we're good at talking and emotionally processing everything, that lesbian partners can be left on that. Well, they'll be good. They'll get on with it together. So they can feel ignored for sort of slightly different reasons.
There's a case study in the book of a couple, and the other mother keeps having to very gently remind medics that, you know, she needs to be on the birth certificate. She needs to be.
Yeah.
That must be very hard.
I think it is. And I it's interesting. Maybe you guys have more of an experience in this. I think there are certainly some fertility clinics in London that I know that's just not the case at all, because they're so used to treating same-sex couples, and it's just very kind of normal. It's not a heteronormative space, but I can't account for the vast range of the NHS at all. But just anecdotally, I think it is a heteronormative space. I think, again, there are moves to change that. But just in my experience of lesbian couples, they will, pretty much every couple I've talked to will have encountered it along the way somewhere. Yeah. They might have one enlightened midwife, but then the next day, you know, you meet so many people when you're pregnant, don't you? Mm-hmm. So it's not uniform. But yeah, that can be, you know, really can only compound a kind of grief to be excluded in that way, and not to, and this whole also idea about it not being kind of there not being a genetic link somehow kind of having an effect on that relationship, which, you know, is a load of bollocks.
Yeah, which must be really hard.
Yeah.
Kind of pushed aside like that because it's not.
Yeah. Well, so does that mean if you adopt a child, then you won't, you know, don't feel the same way? I mean, and I also write about the other, that we still need a lot of more kind of research into the subject as well. So it's not just sort of practice on the ground, but kind of but funding and interest to kind of explore other ways of you know, other family, other ways of building families, and how other partners and family members are affected too.
It comes down to empathy, really, doesn't it? Just being empathetic.
Yeah, empathy and education.
Oh, yeah.
I'll go back to that.
So one of the things you also say, which is interesting, is that, you know, miscarriages give other women permission to talk about miscarriages, which is something that I've definitely experienced within, you know, my friendship group. And you were saying your mother as well. I wonder if mothers don't maybe sometimes open up about that happening to them until it perhaps happens to their daughter.
Well, that's an interesting one. I think that's something I have noticed with, you know, my mother's generation, going back to this idea that, and I'm a bit older than you guys, but my mother's generation, miscarriages were, you know, were in the dark ages there. So they just were not acknowledged. And so there wasn't, you know, the Miscarriage Association charity was set up in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. I could have got this wrong. I think it was 84. You know, it was only really in the late 70s, early 80s, after campaign work, that this was sort of put on the map. So prior to that, there's a whole kind of generations of women who just had all of this kind of pushed under the carpet. So, yes, I've been noticing, and since I've been talking to it, that, as you say, that women are coming, rekindling experiences and rethinking about what they went through their daughters' experiences. Mm. And, you know, I think that's a good thing, although a painful thing. But the kind of miscarriage stories beget miscarriage stories. I think there's something about, you know, there's a safety in that, because it's not, you know, as we come back to a normalised conversation, there aren't these well-oiled roots of conversations that there's such an awkwardness about talking about our infertility and miscarriage. Mm. But as soon as somebody has revealed that, oh, we know, oh, that's safe, it's safe ground, now I can talk about it. But we don't have that permission yet in normal society, because, you know, it's just not there yet.
You give an example of the Nepalese Tamang women about, you know, when you ask them about their children, they'll often list their living children and also the ones that they lost.
Yeah, I have to fess up, of course, this is sort of secondhand knowledge. I read this from an anthropological research. So I just, you know, I wish I'd actually been there and talked to the Tamang women. But according to this anthropologist, they have this tremendous ease about talking about their reproductive lives, and their family life includes those babies that didn't make it. And they'll just talk about it like they talk about their children. It's sort of like what we had for breakfast today, my banana and Marmite. Mm. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah.
That's my personal belief. And that's what I would love to reach to a world where we can just have an ease about it.
But I think, would our culture be able to handle it, do you think? That kind of brutal honesty?
Well, I wouldn't. I don't know.
Mm.
But let's hope.
I suppose with time.
Let's hope. Hopefully. We can just keep chipping away and broadening it out from the ease that we have. I think I make some loose analogy between the sort of Tamang and the kind of online communities. I know they're not wholly Elysian fields, and that, you know, you can have trolling and some discomfort there. But the ease with which the pregnancy loss community talk with each other, just branching that out. I do, you know, I can only reflect on my lifetime of this, which has been 16, 17 years. Mm. And it's a world of difference. It really is. And I reflect on that. You know, I know if I'd gone through the birth of my twins tomorrow, I would have had a very different experience. I don't think it, by no stretch, would it have been perfect and everyone would have understood. But I do think I would have had an easier ride.
I mean, you talk about the fact that as a culture we don't make miscarriage easy to remember, and you know, that there's space to create kind of rituals. We've got rituals around birth, we've got rituals around marriage, we've got rituals around death. We don't have rituals around these kind of, well,
it's almost in between, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I was going to say half lives, but that's not what it is, because they were little lives, but you know, but they were little lives. Do you think those rituals are beginning to establish themselves?
I think they are, actually. I mean, I certainly, again, anecdotally, get the sense that more and more women and couples are turning to rituals. Again, it's like with the naming, when you were asking about that, to kind of cap their experience of a little life that came into their family and then left, and to mark that existence and to make it a part of the family narrative, to put it on the family tree, if you like, metaphorically or otherwise. And those rituals sort of cap that experience, and they are so important to us. I mean, we have them in so many different kind of realms, to mark a transition, to mark a, you know, they mark a difference between what was then and the future. Mm. So they're psychologically and socially really important. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing them more, but they are also happening more and more in hospitals, going back to protocols that are coming into place. And this very much depends on the funding. You might have a hospital that has very little funding and can offer a couple, not many options, but might well offer, say, a shared cremation. But there is a big, well-funded hospital in central London that has a huge charitable fund that will be able to offer a family, a couple, a kind of range of options about how they want to if they want to and how they want to ritualise their loss. So the rituals are happening and happening more in hospitals. Again, you know, I write about this in my book. Nobody asked me. One of my miscarriages was involved having a evacuation of retained products of conception, that phrase, which I think, lovely phrase, we love that, which is, I think, again, being eased out. But nobody asked me what was going to happen to my baby when it was removed from me. I mean, I kind of woke up from it having no idea. I've got a pretty good idea what happened to it. It's put in the sluice. But, and I didn't think anything of it because I just didn't think to ask. But that won't happen now if all goes well. I can't say definitively, but the protocols are changing where, you know, you will be offered a ritual. What would you like to happen to your baby's body when it's been taken out of you?
And there's a kind of move towards encouraging those who've had late pregnancy losses or who've had stillbirths to spend a bit of time with
absolutely.
Their babies.
Absolutely. And to spend time and forge memories and to have an opportunity to parent, to mother that baby and father that baby. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely crucial each to their own, of course, but just again, we know this from the research, and so it isn't just my experience, that it's really crucial for a couple to grieve as best they can, to again, it goes back to acknowledge that this baby existed, and to forge memories and capture memories, to take photos and spend time with that baby. That baby might well have looked like you. I didn't meet my babies, my mother did, and it's lovely to know that, you know, one looked like me and one looked like the dad.
Mm. Really?
Well, that's what she says.
Yeah, you talk about something called the Little Things and Co.
Yes.
Which sounded like a really lovely thing for someone to have thought of. Do you mind kind of explaining that?
She's not alone, actually, but there are other people out there who are volunteering to make clothes for babies to be dressed in after a kind of late miscarriage. And actually, kind of even early on, that Little Things and Co, they make before a baby can be put into clothes, because they might not have developed arms and legs, to have little envelopes or kind of pockets or that are made and supplied to hospitals. It's all done for free. She's got a kind of army of people who do this. There's another company that make them from old wedding dresses, I believe. But just so much kind of love and labour gone into kind of providing this. And a lot of people find this, of course, just it's about dignity as well. Mm-hmm. My babies were not dressed, so you know they went to their cremation undressed, which is, you know, not an easy memory for me, and certainly kind of really, really difficult for a lot of couples to countenance.
So can we move on to, when you're talking to somebody who has experienced a loss, because you know, we talk to people every day who've experienced losses, and every now and then there's a moment where I just think, God, you've had such a horrible time, I actually don't know what to say. One of the things that you say, we should be curious to discover the meaning of a miscarriage for the bereaved.
Gosh, did I say should? I'd like to be a bit more...
You might not have said should, that might be funny.
Well, I go back to this idea time and again that in my experience, when I hear stories of miscarriage, and you asked me in the first podcast last week, 5 minutes ago, about to tell me about the story of my first miscarriage, and I didn't, I began, and I had to kind of edit it because actually, if I wanted to, the story would be much, much longer. But I started with, I met my husband when I was 18, mm-hmm. and I fell in love. And then, you know, 10 years later, we began to think about that baby in mind began. And that baby in was in our mind for a year. So the story of a miscarriage isn't just, I bled lots and it was really agonizing. And then, you know, a tiny embryo or a baby came out of me. The story of a miscarriage, in my experience, always starts with the conception and the trying to conceive and when it began, when that baby began. And I think that in sharing a story of a miscarriage, that's really helpful to begin there. So that's where the curiosity comes in. Tell me about your baby that you lost. And it might be that she or he will say, well, you know, we ended up in A&E, it was bloody awful. We'll go uh-huh. with that. Mm. But it might be, well, we were trying for 3 years and then we went to have three rounds of IVF and then, you know, and this is where you guys know. So I think by being curious about the whole story, you learn the weight of the loss and going back to the weight of the grief and what that meant. It isn't just reduced to, I had a miscarriage.
And if your friend comes up to you and says, I've had a really shit week, I actually had a pregnancy loss this week.
Mm.
I was 9 weeks.
Mm.
I hadn't told anyone.
Mm-hmm.
How should you react? You know, the instinct, I would imagine, for a lot of people is to go, oh, at least it was early. Which is not the right thing to say.
Yeah, at least.
At least you can get pregnant.
I'm really so much more on surer ground about what not to say than what to say.
Yeah.
But I'll be a good girl and try and stick with the what you should say.
The at least
I think it's fair. Anything that begins with the word at least. Don't assume, anyway, I'm drifting off into not want to say, but I think it's safe to start on the basis that, you know, I'm so sorry, that's a shitty thing to happen, isn't it? Even if, going back to this idea, even if it wasn't a major grief for you, maybe you hadn't attached the baby, maybe it was a relief, like the woman on Twitter said, mm-hmm. but it's still a really shitty thing to happen.
Yeah.
Which might well have had a lot of blood and pain and shock, and it was really inconvenient because I was in a meeting or whatever. So to start with that as an opener, I'm so sorry, tell me about it. You know, and I think it's okay to be ignorant. Look, I want to know. Forgive me, I don't know about what this meant for you, and I really want to know. Isn't that sort of a safe opener?
Yeah.
I think.
I suppose when, you know, you might not feel like people want to know the details, so you never get an opportunity to say them. So by inviting them to share whatever they want to share, it's a kind thing to do, is to let them have that permission to say what happened.
Yeah, and also I suppose as against that, be realistic. If you know in yourself that you're going to faint if they start talking about blood, then you might not want to sort of be honest, you know. Say, look, I'm just going to warn you, I'm really sorry, but I, whatever. But, you know, you've got to look up. That, I suppose what I'm guarding against is also opening up a conversation that you can't handle and that you're going to freak out and you're mm-hmm. going to end up being awkward about.
Yeah.
So this goes back to my plug for my book. No, but just getting people to think about, just to think about what they feel about it and what might be corrupting their compassion, understanding, sympathy. And I'm going to kind of backtrack as well, because sort of thinking on my feet here, I don't know about you, but sometimes it's not just about the words. I can think about a couple of really clumsy comments that were made to me. that if said in the abstract, oh, bloody hell. But actually they were said with such love and such compassion, and I could see on their face that they just really, really just wanted to get it right and didn't. And that meant to me the world, as opposed to a wooden, I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
You know, gosh, that must be really horrid. Not that people talk like robots, but you can tell there's a sort of inauthentic lack of empathy. So sometimes it might be maybe not even if you're struggling with the words, you know, I'm so sorry and a hug, I'm so sorry and a plant being sent to them, or a box of chocolates, or a thinking of you, this must be a really shitty time.
And then, you know, how important is it to continue to acknowledge the existence of that?
I think it's important. I really do. Because, you know, you might learn that you've hit a wrong note and it's sort of they don't want to talk about it anymore, and actually it's dealt with. But going back to this idea of miscarriage can often be a profound loss that lasts. And that maybe an 8-week, a miscarriage at 8 weeks was named and memorialised online somewhere privately, because we can't do it publicly because it will be weirded out.
Yeah.
But just to kind of keep that alive.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people who would really value, I certainly do, I'm distracted, but, you know, value that the family that they're presented with also included babies that didn't make it, and that somehow being nodded towards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I feel like we've reached a natural conclusion here. Do you reckon?
Yeah.
Yeah. Julia, you've given us 2 weeks worth of... content.
We've kept you here.
We've kept you here
prisoner
for a very long time.
Can I be unlocked now?
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
And where can we get your book?
You can get your book in all good bookshops.
Yes.
Although I have to say, I'm going to admit to that authorial narcissism of just nipping into Waterstones and in Notting Hill Gate to see if my book was there.
And?
They had one copy that we sold, but I was reassured there were some copies in Kensington High Street and Piccadilly and others. So
they don't have a great like parenting and fertility section in there.
Oh, well, there you go. They're rubbish.
Very disappointing. No. Every stage of my TTC journey.
Oh, well, there you go. You don't want to go there at all anyway.
No. Give that a swerve then. Yeah. Everywhere else.
And and online, of course, I think on the Virago website itself, I like to point people towards.
Well, it's a great book.
Thank you so much.
So thank you for writing it. I think it's important.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm really honoured that you took such close attention to it, and thank you.
We loved it. I loved it.
it's an odd one to pitch.
I know, all the way through we've just gone, yeah, I really enjoy, I mean, I didn't enjoy it.
No.
But anyway, thank you for joining us, Julia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Now it's time for
IVF.
What the F?
What
We're talking about antihistamines.
We are.
Please relate your troubles.
So I have sinus issues and have had for quite some time. I think it hasn't quite been diagnosed, but I think it might be something called non-allergic rhinitis. So it's not hay fever, it's kind of all year round, which is great for me.
My sister has that.
Does she?
She sneezes all the time, it drives me fucking insane.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Sophie.
I mean, I drive people I work with nuts. People have stopped saying bless you completely. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't say that 20 million times a day.
You don't annoy me, though. My sister really annoys me, so how's that?
Oh, well, I think certain times of the day it's worse, so I don't really see you. In the evenings, I'm fine.
Okay.
Morning times, and during the day at work, or maybe I'm just allergic to work. yeah, I get it pretty bad. And yeah, it's been worse since I've been pregnant.
Okay.
And I have kind of looked into cursory look at whether you can take antihistamines, and it seems to be kind of like not sure, maybe don't, kind of thing.
And this is an issue like if you're pregnant, but also if you're trying for a baby. And
yeah, exactly, if you're taking any sort of medication during this whole process, you're kind of like, is it okay?
Yeah,
should I do it? So yeah, we kind of thought we'd put it to Professor Tim. As I say, some listeners have written in as well with the same problem, so
yeah,
we thought we'd ask him.
Cool, and here's what he had to say.
So antihistamines, there's obviously quite a number of them, and so it's a difficult one to answer this one. The safest thing always, clearly, is going to be to have a look on the drug information leaflet that will be inside the box that the antihistamine came with, or to speak to a pharmacist. The pharmacists obviously are really fully aware of risk of taking drugs when trying to conceive or in early pregnancy. If you are worried about it, then the sort of the nasal spray antihistamines, there's much less of that is absorbed into the body compared to antihistamine tablets. But in general, there's not a problem using these drugs, but because of the wide range of them, as I said, it's safest just to check.
Thanks, Professor Tim.
Gabriella, how are you?
I am well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Cool.
What's been happening? So last time we spoke, I was about to go to the doctor for an undisclosed reason. basically I went along the next morning, and it was quite funny because I was sitting in the waiting room and there were lots of heavily pregnant women there and me, which I think
feels so great, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was weird. I've got some serious imposter syndrome, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, went into the doctor's room and she was like, "Hi, so hopefully you'll be able to tell us why you're here because we can't work it out."
What?
Yeah. She had my notes and she was like, "Yeah, we've looked at your notes. We're not really sure why this appointment has been put here." So, and I was like, "I think it might be something to do with IVF." And she was like, "Oh, yes. Okay, yes. Oh, you've done IVF. Right, okay." And then she was just like, "Why did you do IVF?" And I was like, "My husband's sperm isn't great." She was like, "Nothing wrong with you?" And I was like, "Not that I know of." And she was like, "Right, okay, well, then in that case, I think everything looks to be fine. There's no reason to treat this pregnancy any differently. That's
good.
It. And I was like, "Oh, okay."
Sometimes you just want to be made to feel like a special princess.
Yeah. What do you mean I'm not special? So that was fine, like, whatever. But she also, they did a urine sample to make sure that my urine bug had gone.
Oh, yeah.
And it had.
Oh, good.
And then also they did listen to the heartbeat with one of those Doppler machines.
Which is really cool.
Yeah, I was quite happy about it because I was, as discussed, I had kind of a bit freaked out and kind of wanted to scan, but didn't want to scam the scan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was satisfied with listening to the heartbeat. It was quite nice. But she did say, she was like, "Oh, there's a chance we won't be able to hear anything. And, you know, if we can't, it's probably because of the position of the baby. And I don't want you to freak out." And I was like, "Mate, there is no chance in hell that I am not going to freak out if we can't hear the heartbeat. Like, that is not going to be a calm situation."
Yeah.
And my husband was travelling for work at the time. So the minute she said that, my brain was like, "Okay, what am I going to do if there's no heartbeat? Who am I going to call? How am I going to get through the day if this is the case?" And yeah, obviously 10 seconds later it was all fine.
Oh my god.
I know. Someone has like many freakouts.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was that really. And other than that, yeah, my kind of imposter syndrome has been quite funny. Like I can't wear a badge on the tube. I feel very uncomfortable just because I don't feel like I look pregnant, and I don't know. I just feel weird about it. And we went for some treatments yesterday, didn't we?
We did, and it was lovely.
Yeah, and I had a pregnancy massage. And again, it was kind of all set up for properly pregnant women, do you know what I mean?
Well, she did come and say, she basically came up to me and was like, I'll be doing you. And I was like, for a pedicure? And she was like, no, oh no. I was like, you're doing my mate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was like, I'm pregnant too.
It is a hard period though. Like, I found it really hard at that point, the imposter syndrome.
Mm.
Because, and especially when you're going to the antenatal clinic, I don't understand why everybody at the antenatal clinic is so heavily pregnant. Like, why are there not normal people there?
Who are in their
first and second trimesters?
Yeah.
Or do people just show really early and you and I happen to not?
I don't know. I think it's just, I reckon you probably have more appointments when you're that heavily pregnant,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
So the chances of having people who are in the early stages is kind of less, I guess. I don't know. Fucking hell. But it was me in a room full of quite heavily pregnant people. So I was just a bit like, oh God. And yeah, so the massage, the pregnancy massage, she was like, okay, so this pillow goes under your bump. And I was kind of like, oh, yeah, because we really need that because I've got a huge bump, obviously. Not. I just felt like, I don't know, it was weird.
But it was a nice massage.
It was a lovely massage, yeah. Yeah, yeah, totally. I think I probably could have just had a normal massage though.
Yeah, maybe, but you know, you don't want to like get pressed in the wrong places. Like,
no.
Because we tried to book a pedicure a few weeks ago, didn't we?
Because,
You know, we're those kinds of people. We just go for treatments.
Little treats.
All the time.
I don't go for fucking treatments.
I never go
ever.
For treatments.
I was so awkward getting this massage. I didn't know what I was like. Do I take all my clothes off? What do I do? I've never done this before.
I find it really awkward as well. But we tried to book a pedicure and they were like, oh. And this was a really funny conversation because I booked it and then they were like, oh, do you have any kind of medical requirements, any medical needs? And I was like, well, we're both pregnant. And she was like, oh, how pregnant are you? And I was like, oh, I think at that point you were about 11 weeks or 10 weeks or something.
10 weeks, isn't it? Yeah.
And I was whatever. And she was like, oh, we can't do it before 12 weeks. And I was like, why not? And she was like, oh, there are pressure points that could induce labour. And I was like, but I don't want labour induced either.
Weird.
It was really weird. But yeah, so.
Yeah. So it was good to have a pregnancy massage,
yeah,
rather
so.
Than just any old massage.
Yeah.
But I did feel a bit like I needed a much bigger bump to have a valid reason to be there, if you know what I mean.
The imposter syndrome is horrible.
Yeah. But it's fine. It's not, you know, whatever. It is what it is. But I am getting, like, seeing my friends and they're like, oh, I thought you'd be more pregnant. Like, you don't look pregnant. And I'm kind of like, don't say that because it goes into my brain and I think I'm not pregnant. I'm like, what if there isn't anything in there? Oh,
there
God.
Is, though.
Yeah.
There is. You heard the heartbeat.
Yeah.
But yeah, I spent the whole of my first and most of my second trimesters being like, someone's going to jump up out at me and tell me it's all a big joke.
Yeah.
Be like, ta-da!
Yeah.
And you're like,
lol, you fell for it, you
yeah,
fool.
Yeah, exactly. I still feel a bit like that.
Yeah.
I've got a big old bump.
You do have a big old bump now. So adding to the imposter syndrome thing is the fact that all of my app, the books I've got, everything is like, you should maybe start to feel kicks around now, blah, blah, blah. Just, you know, look out for a little flutter, blah, blah, blah. And my auntie was like, oh, when you get to 16 weeks, like, you'll be able to feel the baby kick, like, text me when you do. And basically, I haven't felt anything yet. And it's possibly because I have what they call an anterior placenta, which is what you had, mm-hmm. Emma. And it's the placenta at the front, not the back, which means that if the baby's kicking, it's kicking the placenta.
Yeah.
So you can't really feel it.
Yeah.
So they say that it could be up to like, what, 20?
25 weeks.
25 weeks before I feel anything.
I was 21, 22, I think.
Which is a bit just disappointing, really. I'm just like, that would really help if I could feel something.
Well, I was saying to you that when we recorded, a lot of people won't have listened to the pregnancy special, but when we recorded that, we had Kat and Roma, and I think Roma was about 18 weeks. Kat was a little bit further, wasn't
yeah.
she? And they were both saying, oh yeah, it's really, it's really nice that we can feel kicks now. We find it really reassuring. And then I was about 12, 13 weeks. And I was just like in my head, like, I'm not going to feel kicks for ages. And I was like quite jealous of them.
Mm.
And yeah, I think, yeah, I must have been about 22 weeks before I felt it. And it is like a bit, it's a bit disappointing.
Yeah. I think it's that reassurance that you're just not going to get that for a while. I'd quite like that now.
Yeah.
But
you'll get it eventually. It's not the end of the world. It's just a bit more of a wait. The thing is that, like, one thing we're good at is waiting.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Very good at waiting. Yeah.
And just, you know, and just, like, putting aside the fucking little voice and the fears and just being like, look, no, all other evidence suggests I'm still pregnant. Like, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
It is fine.
Scary shit, though.
I know. Speaking of which, mate, how are you?
No, wait. What? 16 weeks.
Oh, what?
Yep. It's present time. I'm just going to get up and get the present, listeners.
You are too much. Yay. I love it.
It's not the best surprise this time because I told you I was buying it. And you know how much it cost.
But I love it.
I accidentally bought two of the same top from Topshop.
How did you buy two of the same top? Just to slip of the finger on
them. Added them to both of the basket? I don't know. But it's a cool top.
It's a really nice kind of pale blush pink shirt.
Yeah. Shirty jackety thing. Like it's like a short sleeved.
Yeah, I really like it. I think it's gorgeous.
I'm not sure about the buttons. They're a bit weird and lumpy.
They're a bit wubby subby.
Yeah. They look like bees, the letter B.
They do look like bees.
Yeah.
Or an embryo.
appropriate. Yeah. So, happy 16 weeks.
Thank you. That's very kind. You are too kind. She's too good to me, guys. She's too good to me.
You know, somebody sent me brownies the other day because she said that I'm not the only one that gives gifts.
Oh.
Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
They were really delicious. I didn't share them.
Oh, I feel very spoiled, put it that way.
Good. As to your question.
Yes, how are you?
I'm fine. So we've now, in our NCT group, had 5 babies.
Ooh.
And I've got to say, I'm starting to think about having a baby.
Right, yeah.
I'm not thinking about what has passed. I'm thinking about what is to come. I'm very jealous of the people who've had babies.
Mm.
Like I'm, it's the same feeling of jealousy, only I know I'm getting a baby at the end.
So it's kind of all right.
Yeah, it's like the infertility envy, only there's very high likelihood that there will actually be a baby afterwards.
Yeah, so it's only a pang of jealousy rather than a deep-seated hatred.
Yeah.
And remind us, your NCT group are all a month ahead of you, right?
Yeah, they're all about a month ahead of me. So I've got another...
So that's why that's happening.
Yeah, so I've got 4 working days. By the time this goes out, I'll have 2 working days until I go on maternity leave.
Wowzers.
My mum, you were here yesterday when my mum brought round a fucking haul of... stuff like little cardigans, little baby grows, and blankets, all that kind of stuff, which is really great because it means I don't have to go and buy it, which is really great because I still freak out at the prospect of buying baby stuff, like freak the fuck out. So she bought all this stuff and it was like so generous and so nice.
It was great fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Just like all this tiny baby stuff. And then the other thing that happened is, as discussed last week, we were thinking about packing my hospital bag.
Yes.
Did we discuss that? We did
discuss
that.
Yeah, we did.
And so one of the things that they say you have to take is maternity pads.
Oh, yeah. That was funny.
And I just went and stood in Sainsbury's and looked at, like, all the stuff.
Do they have specific maternity pads?
I couldn't see anything that said maternity pad on it. All I could see is Tenor Lady. And I'm sorry, but it just has connotations that I'm not prepared to buy into right now.
Yeah.
So, but then I've been getting all the birth stories off the NCT ladies and fuck me. It's like, you need some kind of very seriously absorbent.
You should ask them what brand they went for.
Well, they just said they went on Amazon and bought stuff. But it's great that I'm thinking about this stuff. Like, I'm thinking about,
yeah,
you know, like, stuff that normal pregnant people think about.
Yes, finally.
Yeah, finally. And it's really, like, exciting. And I am now so excited about meeting this little thing that's, like, wriggling around so much all the time.
Yeah.
Which I love. And it's just so calming and, like, reassuring.
Yeah.
Also a bit uncomfortable, but that's okay. We're okay with that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess in summary, I'm excited. I'm a little jealous of the NCT ladies.
Yeah.
I'm a little overwhelmed by like the things we still have to buy and the preparations we still have to make. Although somebody had pointed out to me that Amazon will still exist after I give birth.
And very conveniently.
Yes, exactly. Say, yeah. And shops will still be open.
Yes. It's not Christmas Day.
It's not Christmas Day.
That'll be me.
Yeah, that will be you. So yeah, I'm beginning to allow myself to get excited.
Good.
I guess that's,
yeah,
that's it. And that's a really nice feeling. And that's it for this episode.
That's a wrap.
Next week we are going to be talking to Genevieve Roberts. Literally famous.
That is a delight.
Yeah. She basically did IVF as a single lady.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she's written a book actually about having a baby by herself.
Yeah.
And actually two babies. And yeah, we had a really nice chat with her.
Yes.
So
we did.
Please enjoy that.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a good week, guys.
Bye.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.